Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, a Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the dutiful Dungeon Masters Block, the astounding Amadea Rosa, and the captivating Kathleen Halpert. Today, we have myself, Ange, along with Josh and JT, and we are going to talk about system screen burn, or when you've got rules from one system stuck in your head as you try and run a different one. Game long enough, and you will experience this, I guarantee it. Before we dive into that topic, though, we're going to ask our Get to Know a Gnome question, which today, have you ever made the same character in different systems? And if you did, how did that go? Josh, I'm going to start with you.
So I haven't really made the same character in multiple tabletop RPGs, but I have like ported over tabletop characters into video games. Like a lot of times when I play games with my husband, either like World of Warcraft or Diablo or Baldur's Gate 3 or anything where you get to make your character or even just name them, we'll usually pull from like our tabletop catalog and like give those characters new life in a new universe, essentially like the Spider-Verse version of our characters.
Yeah, I think most of my when I played Neverwinter, the online game, a decade ago at this point, I think most of my characters were based on TTRPG characters I had made over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it takes you long enough to make the character the way you want it in the character maker. Like, that's its own mini game.
Right.
But like starting with like a character you already know, so you already know like the personality and you kind of know like how they work, it helps get rolling in the new video game a little easier, I think.
Yeah. JT, what about you?
So I can only think of one instance that I've done this, and it's kind of, sort of, yes, no, different systems, but my very first D&D character that I made was in the Mincer Redbox D&D basic set, and he was an elf. Not an elf fighter, not an elf this, something else, because elf was it, end of story. It was a class. Elf, dwarf, halfling were classes in your Beckme D&D. And I, you know, advanced him up through the expert companion master set. I didn't advance him into the Immortals box set because the Immortals box set was just a little out there. It was a little weird. It was part of Beckme, but it was a little too weird even for me. So I never made him an immortal to go battle Demogorgon and Orcus and, or whoever else. Right. In the late 80s, when I got into second edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, I did convert him from Beckme to an Elven Ranger magic user. And I'm not even sure that was a legal combo back then. I don't remember if Ranger had to be like just a Ranger. But I did it anyway because that's how I was playing him in Beckme, as a Ranger magic user. And my gaming group had long ago thrown out the max level by race rule because we just thought that was fairly stupid.
Very.
And to this day, and I'm in a first edition AD&D campaign now, and we threw out that rule. That was like one of the first house rules that we agreed upon was no max level based on class race combo. And I did get him to fairly insane high levels as Ranger Magic user before retiring the character. He was just stupid powerful. and I got his character sheets somewhere behind in a folder behind me on the shelves behind me now. So I never did advance him into third edition D&D when that came out because there really was no point. He'd be a 30th level Ranger, 30th level Magic user kind of thing in the third edition system. So it was just... why? He's retired now. He's enjoying his wine at his chalet somewhere. So
I just remembered that I had a friend in college, and he insisted on playing the same character in every game that he played. And it wasn't because he was like overly precious about this character or like he wanted to like port over all of the awesome gear that he had won or any, it wasn't like any of the like the toxic traits of I will only play this character that you see. It was because his group in high school was so prone to like starting a campaign and then getting bored with it and then starting something new in a new system,
right,
and then getting bored with it and then starting, like, they jumped from so many games and he just wanted some amount of consistency. So, so he was like, okay, you guys can do all of that, but I'm going to play the same character.
You know, my story is actually somewhat related to that. I have a character, goes by the name of Avalon. She is a reincarnated King Arthur. Fun. And I made her in a Marvel Saga game that was supposed to be a campaign, but it was going to be a campaign that we played when we were able to get together. And the she was based a little bit on a little bit of the graphic novel Camelot 3000 and a little bit of Superboy from Young Justice. Mm-hmm. Grown in a vat, infused with a personality, like a little bit of magic, a little bit of science, and here she is. As a woman, not a man, going, what the heck is going on? But still with all the be the big damn hero type of goals. In that original Marvel Saga game, I only got to play her twice.
Oh, ouch.
And I was like, oh, such a good concept. I really wanted to dig into her. And then like a couple of years later, a bunch of my friends and I decided we were going to do a game together. We'd play once a month, play in person at cons when we're all together, that type of thing. And I asked the GM, hey, can I reuse a concept I had? And I kind of pitched the idea to him. And it was using Mutants and Masterminds instead of Marvel Saga. It was set in the 1970s instead of a nebulous modern time frame. And he's like, yeah, sure, if you're willing to transport the ideas into this setting. And I'm like, yes. So Avalon got rebuilt as a grown adult, similar concept, and it was just so much fun getting to play her finally and giving her an actual full story arc.
Cool.
You know, we even had reincarnated versions of Guinevere and Lancelot, and we had Merlin was another PC, and it ended up being a lot of fun to basically take a concept I had in another game system, but I didn't get to fully flesh out, and bring it into a new game to finally get to play her.
Heck yeah. That's awesome.
That's cool.
So moving on into our main topic, as many of us here at Gnome Stew will tell you, there's a wealth of games out there just waiting to be played. The thing is, there's a lot of variation between the mechanics of those games. What type of dice does it use? How does it handle stats? How does it handle movement? Are there ways to modify the rules? Even if you're playing the same game, what edition are you playing? My group has jokingly referred to this as system screen burn, leaning into the idea that certain rules get stuck in our heads, and it can sometimes be hard to separate edition from edition, system from system. So we're going to talk about this. What is a mechanic or rule that you have struggled with in between game systems?
It doesn't matter what version of a D20 system I am running, I will give the wrong name for the saving throw.
There you go.
And it's not consistent. Like I won't always say like, just give me a dex save when I'm playing Pathfinder and it's reflex or something like that. If I am running a system, I will give the wrong name for the saving throw. thankfully, they're all pretty analogous. You know, the table gets it and then they laugh at me. I'm like, yeah, whatever. But also, like, I found playing a lot of Pathfinder 2e, especially the remastered edition, where they, you know, they divorced themselves from the OGL, they made the ORC, and they had to, like, file off all the serial numbers and rename a whole bunch of stuff. And for, like, good reasons, like, I'm down for it, and I'm trying to teach my brain the new names, but I'm still like, oh, no, you've got flanking, I mean, off guard, or something along those lines. They're the same thing. It's just the name has been changed to protect the innocent, and I can't get it through my skull.
Yeah, that would be hard for me too.
I know I go back and forth on perception versus notice from my D20 based games to my Savage Worlds based games. It's notice in Savage Worlds, but I'll still go, give me a perception check.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
People look at me like, do you mean a notice check? And I'm like, let me know if you see things or hear things. Just do the thing.
Yeah, that's one of mine as well. Your perception and your stealth type skills. It seems like every game has to come up with some new synonym for perception, stealth, hiding, whatever. And it honestly annoys me. You're not making yourself yourself unique in your game mechanics. You're making yourself more difficult to play. Just go with the flow with the standards, right? Don't be Microsoft to make a new standard for the same old thing just to make a new standard. It's not going to replace the 20 previous existing standards. It's just going to add a 21st standard that everybody has to learn.
I do think it's a balancing act for designers in trying to make their system feel like something specific to what they're designing, but also, like you say, not rewriting the world just because you feel like you need to come up with a new name.
Yeah.
Like we were starting to mention initiative, and in Savage Worlds, initiative is a completely different system.
Sure. And I'm okay with that because it's totally different.
Totally different. But it is still one of those things like how does this work in this system?
Stealth systems too, like you were saying, are not just the, like the name of the skill role or something like that, but like the way hiding works. It's like hiding is the hidden grappling check. Like everybody knows that grappling checks are confusing and no game has like gotten the way to do grappling and wrestling. But like stealth checks are also like stealth checks and hiding are also high on that list and people don't realize it because they're hidden. But like I've been running Pathfinder 2E for like 5 years now. I still don't know how hiding works in that game.
Yeah.
You mentioned before flanking, and 5e has been out for 10 years. They over 10 years at this point, they dropped flanking with the introduction of fifth edition, and we still talk about flanking in all of my D&D games. It's
Wait,
like, are you
wait, wait,
flanking?
wait.
Do I need to be
Flanking's
flanking to get
not a
my.
thing in fifth edition?
It's optional. It's an
Oh,
optional
because
rule.
in my group, it's a thing.
It Okay.
basically, it's an optional rule, and
Gotcha.
it's not necessary for rogues anymore to be quote unquote
Right, I
flanking
remember that.
to
Yeah.
get their sneak attack damage. They just need to have an ally that is also adjacent to that target, or they need to have advantage.
Right.
You know, so it's like people still get very caught up in like, am I flanking? Do I need flanking? But I haven't actually, like, I didn't know there were people out there playing with it in is an optional rule because I haven't touched it in years.
Gotcha. Yeah, we even incorporate that into our first edition AD&D, which is not a thing. It's probably in some Dragon magazine or buried deep in the Unearthed Arcana or something like that, but it just makes sense. And it's easy.
So why is it important that we get the mechanics of any given game correct? Because technically we're at our tables. We can do what we want.
Right. Yeah. For me, I don't think it's too horribly important, with two caveats: fairness to the group as a whole, that includes the game master, and consistency in gameplay. If I got flanking last round and I'm in the same position this round, I get flanking this round. If the game master is like, "Well, I'm tired of you having flank," so no, that's inconsistent, right? That's not fair. That's not the game mechanics that we as a group have agreed upon. So you, Game Master, say no just because you're tired of me having flank, then sorry, go pound sand, but just be consistent and fair. There's a caveat to the caveat, however. The major exception to that is if you're running a game at a con, people are going to show up knowing the rules, or maybe they're new, whatever. You don't want to teach them the quote wrong rules. And if they know the rules, you need to present that experience rules as written as closely as you can. Especially if you're running organized play, that's even more important there.
Yes, if you're running organized play, you absolutely need to be running the game system that you have been contracted is the wrong term,
Yeah.
that you have agreed to
There you
run
go.
for this group.
Absolutely.
The social contract at the table.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, I do think if you are going to try a new system with your game group, you should try and run it with the mechanics of that game to understand why they decided to have those mechanics in the game.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes there you can read a rule and be like, well, I don't like that. I like it better from this other system. Before you swap it out for the version you like, play with it. You might find out that, oh, they did this for a specific reason. And on the other side of the coin as to what you say to cons, JT, if I'm as long as it's not organized play, I will tell people, hey, I am running this game. These are the things I'm going to do differently than rules is written. And I will be upfront with them about it ahead of time.
Yeah, that's fair.
I love a lot of the Free League games. Vaesen and Tales from the Loop are two of my common games I've run at cons. Tales from the Loop doesn't have this issue because it has other mechanics in place for the players to try and succeed at things. But in Vaesen, that get a six on a D6 in a pool of D6s thing is harder than you think, and it can be really punishing. So I have just flat out told people, if you take a condition to do a reroll, I'm going to give you a soft success, regardless of what you get on your reroll.
Cool.
You know, you will succeed at the thing you are trying to do. It just may be success with a complication if you don't actually get any successes.
Right.
Just because I've grown too tired of being at the table and have somebody have a pool of 10 D6s, not get anything, take a condition to do a reroll, and still not get a success.
Right. Not roll anything higher than a 3. I can't tell you how many times that happened when I was running Vaesen.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I do that, because like, I get why they do it the way they do it in some of their systems, but I'm like, I'm a cream puff. I want my players to succeed. No.
I think it's important to get the mechanics right for all of the reasons that you folks have said, like, you know, new players, we want to make sure that we're teaching them the correct terms, you know, getting the experience of the mechanics correct. But also, I think it's important, if especially if we're switching systems, trying something new, being almost dogmatic about like making sure I'm using the right term for, you know, flanking or off guard,
yeah,
or that I'm, you know, rolling the correct way for initiative. It's going to help the table decide whether or not we like the game.
Yeah.
Right. Because if we were like, well, I don't like this initiative system, I'm just going to use the one that we always use, then like, why aren't we just playing the game that we always play? Like, the point of trying something new is to try it. So like, that's one of the reasons I think it's really important to try to make sure we are as true to it as possible. And also, once you get used to it, despite the burn in, it does make things go faster at the table.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you have to look up rules. Like, if I'm sitting there trying to look up, you know, what bonus does a Mind Flayer get on a deck save, but I'm playing Pathfinder, then I'm not going to find that answer anywhere. So,
one thing I will say before we move on to another question here is, it's okay to get the rules wrong as you're learning a game.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You're going to just accept that.
If I have not played a game before I try and run it, I guarantee you I'm going to completely botch up those rules. And once I've done that, I can then go back and be like, oh, now I understand what they were saying on the page where this rule is written. And usually I, you know, and if it's a game I'm going to be running at a con, I'm hopefully doing it as a play test with my players. If it's a game me and my regular groups are running, everyone knows, hey, I'm figuring this out as you guys are figuring this out. So everyone has that touch of grace to let you get through having the rules wrong. You know, but it's okay to screw it up as you're learning it. You just want to make sure that you fix those screw ups as you get going.
Absolutely.
So where do homebrew rules fit in this equation?
So I'm going to put on my author hat real quick and go to advice that is given to new or intermediate authors at various classes, conferences, so on and so forth. You need to know the rules before you break the rules. You know, there's this whole thing of never use a goddamn adverb. Sorry, screw you, Stephen King. They still exist in the language. That means they're valid language. I wholeheartedly disagree about the never. I don't like absolutes. It was what it boils down to, right?
Yeah.
If we're never allowed to use an adverb, adverbs would be removed from the dictionary. They'd be removed from use in English, yada, yada, yada. However, you need to learn the appropriate time and place to use an adverb. So you need to know the rules, like passive voice. Typically want to avoid passive sentences, and that's where the subject of the verb is the object of the sentence. Yeah, I'm getting all grammarly here on you. The boy was hit by the ball, or the ball hit the boy. Whose point of view are you? If you're in the boy's point of view, maybe the boy was hit by the ball, which is weaker. That's okay, because you're putting the boy first, because he's the point of view of the story. There's better ways to write that. That's the classic example. To bring that back to house ruling, understand the intent and purpose of the rule you're about to change and why it exists the way it does, And if you still disagree with it or don't like it or see some way to improve it within your group, then hit the house rule button and go make changes.
Yeah. I think it also depends on what's the nature of the rule that you're homebrewing in. For example, I tend to treat the way Gumshoe runs mysteries as a philosophy rather than a rule.
Fair enough.
You know, it's the, you give the players the clue, the role just determines how much information they get out of the clue. You know, and that is more of a philosophy of how to run the game rather than a homebrew plug-in in any given game, if that makes sense.
Yep. I've even done for Gumshoe-style stuff. They're going to get the clue, but the role determines how long it takes them to discover the clue. And if there's time pressure involved, that can change the course of the game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And see, like, the great thing about this is that if you had been running Gumshoe, like, it was, you know, a 3.5 clone where, you know, you got to get the success to get the clue, then you would never have come to the realization of how awesome it is to just give them the clue, but then have degrees of success with the, with how you're giving them. So like learning the system correctly is, you know, beneficial in all of the other games that you're bringing.
Oh, yeah.
As well. I have a horrible example of why you don't homebrew before you play the system. I was running a Big Eyes Small Mouth game, and this actually came out of wanting a much different experience than we had had at the table. So for like a couple of years, we'd been running a lot of White Wolf games, you know, a lot of skill-based dots. And, you know, you put all of your dots into the skills and then you add them to your attributes, and that's how you make your die pool and everything like that. And I wanted to have like this new, fresh experience for us. So I was like, you know what? We're not going to do skills in the game. I'm just going to remove that completely. And it's going to be based completely on the narrative. So if like in your backstory, you're like, I lived in the wilderness, raised by wolves, then anything to do with the wilderness or wolves or animals or whatever, you can do that thing. I did not remove the points from the point buy system that they would put into skills.
Oh.
So all of my players came to the table and they were like, yeah, so we built all these characters and they're really powerful because we didn't have to spend any points on skills. Should have thought that through, or maybe, you know, tried the game as it was meant to be played first before I started messing with it.
How do you knock your players or yourself into the right frame of mind when you're trying a new system with a drastically different core loop? For example, you know, stopping the party from trying to fight everything if you're moving from D&D to Call of Cthulhu.
Three letters, TPK. No, I'm kidding.
Oh my God, JT, do you know often I am telling people to not solve out-of-game problems with in-game solutions?
Oh, I know. That's why it's a joke. I hope our listeners are taking that as intended. A total joke. Yes. Yeah. So for me, that's completely session zero material with some reminders throughout the game, little hints and nudges. It really depends on the theme and tone and style of the gameplay that's being presented up front. And if it's a drastic change, like your example, D&D to Cthulhu, then I think extra emphasis needs to be put on the shift. Like explain, here's how we play D&D. Here's how I expect the players to interact with the big bad nasties in Cthulhu. So, you know, running away is an option. Investigating is expected. You know, drawing your silver knife or your derringer or whatever on the elder god, probably not advisable. I'm going to let you do it if you want to, but, you know, I'm not going to stop you, but there's going to be consequences. All right, let's play the game.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this is definitely a session zero thing that needs to be discussed. Or if you're running a con game, just, you know, kind of give the precepts of the game. One of the things I've enjoyed about the Free League games is they have a list of the principles of their game that you are supposed to share with your players before you start. So like Tales from the Loop, you're playing preteens. You're playing anywhere from 10 to 14 years old. These are kids. In our modern concept of children, oh my God, what do you mean they're running around the town without their parents? Oh my goodness. Or no, they found a crime. They need to go report it to the police, or they need to go tell their parents. The principles of the game tell you right up front, the adults are out of touch and cannot solve the problems.
Right.
You know, so I always emphasize this because the first time I ran Tales from the Loop, I had a player insist that the solution was to tell his mom so she could deal with the problem. And I was trying to deal with this in game by like trying to nudge them back into trying to solve the mystery and save the people that were going to be damaged by this. And he kept insisting, no, 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 my mom will take care of it. My mom will take care of it. And I finally hit stop the game, call for timeout, and I explain, look, the adults can't solve your problems. This game is about the kids solving the problem. And if you guys don't follow this through, there are NPCs that will get hurt and or die. And I'm like, I already have a couple of players that are super invested in these NPCs, and I don't want their tears at my table because I couldn't get you into the game like I needed to just through maneuvering you inside the game. So I had to have that out of character conversation to explain, you guys solve the mystery, you guys solve the problem, rather than just leaning into our personal experience of, oh, no, 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 no. A 13-year-old should not be doing this. A 13-year-old should be telling an adult. That's not the game we're playing. So you have to have those conversations with your players sometimes.
Yep.
One of the things I think works pretty well to like get everybody on the same page is to really focus on the opening scenes. Make sure the opening scenes for at least the first few sessions are really geared towards that new play style.
Yes.
And really focus on like, this is the thing that the game does well. And I say opening scenes because that's usually when like you as the GM have the most control. Like you can say, all right, we're opening up here and this is the situation. And it's before your players have any choices to make, which you want them to make, and you want them to do their own thing and have their agency. But in that opening scene, you can say, okay, here is the skate park where we're going to be doing sick flips and tricks. If you're playing, Slug Blaster, I think is the skating through alternate dimensions RPG that's out now that I really want to try.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it looks really cool. But like in those opening scenes, it drives it home. It makes it like the first thing that you're dealing with, sets the tone for the rest of the session. And like you have that control as a GM. You don't have to try to finagle anything or, you know, lead them in any particular direction. You can just set that opening scene and then let them go from there.
No, that's a really good idea. And I know when I'm running a one shot at conventions, I try and have some of the earlier scenes set the tone for the game I'm running, whether that's giving them a slight introduction into combat, giving them a slight introduction into the tone of the world. Give the players the tools they need so they know how to fit their characters into that world.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are some tools you use to try and keep things straight between game systems?
So I like to try to use psychological triggers, both for myself and for my players. Like I always try to do the same opening, like say the same things when I'm opening up a game. It's sort of like my pregame ritual to get everybody into the space. I run a lot of games online, so I can't really control the environment, but I can control what I'm saying to my players. So like they always come into the same splash page on the VTT, mm-hmm. right? And I always say the same thing to kick off the session. And if we're going to do a new game in a new system with a new feel, then I'm going to switch that up. I'm going to change the splash page. I'm going to change the music that's playing as we come in. I'm going to change what I say just to give like those subtle psychological hints that this is something new. This is something different. Let's change our frame of mind.
What about you, JT?
So two tips. The first one, the quicker one, is to create custom quick reference sheets, usually one page, double-sided, no more than that, and keep it of a sizable font, you know, so that people that are of, you know, a certain age like me, 50 plus, can actually, you know, read it easily. And I hand those out to my players, and I keep one for me to keep handy. I also create a custom GM screen. I think it's Hammer Dog Games. They have the ultimate GM screen as their product. And all it is a GM screen with clear inserts, or not inserts, mm-hmm. but clear pockets where you can insert your own pages. I create my own GM screen from scratch. I don't copy paste out of the rule book. I will open up Excel and make tables and copy paste that into Word so that I can do layout. But I'm literally typing the entirety of the tables or short descriptions of conditions or whatever quick rough thing I've got to look up. And that helps cement it more in my mind and helps potentially purge previous editions of the same game's mechanics or numbers or whatever. It's just a really good process for me to go through that creative effort. And yeah, it takes some time, but I for me, it's really worth it. It speeds up the in-game interactions because I know I put that table on the far left panel in the upper right corner, so on and so forth. So I immediately can recall it or recall where it's at so I can reference it. And I wrote an OMSTU article about this a bajillion years ago. And there'll be a link in the show notes for this article or for this episode linking to the custom GM screen article that I wrote. So those are my two.
I do reference sheets, cheat sheets as well. Although I have no shame in copying and pasting from the book because I usually play with the formatting enough that I basically am working with the text enough that it starts sinking into my brain.
Right.
The other thing I will do is when I'm actually running the game, I will take note of the places where my players are needing the reminders and the help to know they're in a different system. For example, I've been running a Tales of the Valiant campaign with my group that has very often played 5th edition D&D. And it's very similar, but there's just enough different. And like one of the areas I find that has been helping is reminding my players when they earn a luck point. Because that is their replacement for inspiration. And so it's their job to keep track of when they earn it, rather than, you know, me just willy-nilly giving it out to them. So it's good to like, oh, hey, you failed that roll. You earned a luck point. And so they know, and it starts getting set a little more in stone with them.
Nice.
I really, really love the idea of both making your own GM screen and taking note of where the players are stumbling. Mm-hmm. Because that's both like, those are both like active learning techniques, right?
Yeah.
To like get the stuff stuck in your head. And that's really cool. That's really awesome. I love getting that a lot.
Any last words on system screen burn before we move out of here?
I'm about to start a Wild Sea campaign and I am going to use these techniques to help myself get the system in my head.
For me, on the house rule front, if you make house rules, make sure they're available to the players between session, like a digital doc. You're sharing your Google Doc, your Dropbox file, whatever. That way they can review it between sessions. Make sure you have printouts of it so that they can review that during the session. Just keep it handy. It's on top of everybody's mind. You know, here's the rules we agreed to, that kind of thing. So.
And the last thing I'll say is just a repeat of what I said before. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Most of the people you're playing with are your friends. And if they're not, I'm questioning why you're playing. You know, everyone's here to have a good time. You make a mistake, just own up to it, fix the rule next session, and keep going. So getting us out of here, this show is funded by the Gnomes 2 Patreon. You two can Patreon back by following the Patreon link at the Gnomes 2 website, the Gnomes 2 Patreon. We love doing this and our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network. So if you're enjoying us, here's another show to check out.
That go with advantage. Ange and Jared love talking about RPGs and D&D. Together, they share insights into the games they're running and then move on to tackle a variety of topics that affect running and playing D&D and related fantasy games. You might even pick up an ancient D&D factoid about a previous edition that you'll never use.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with GnomeStew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Meta. Though with the state of the world, the activity of these various social medias are, you know, they're in flux. Gnomes, is there anything else you want to give a shout out to today?
So I'm going to mention The Monster Overhaul. It is a book by Skirples is the author name. Really neat name, but I hope it's a pen name. Anyway, The Monster Overhaul is a system agnostic fantasy based book on how to treat monsters differently, a different approach. So the link to it will be in the show notes on how to get it. It's a fantastic read. If you're curious about really what all it entails, I highly recommend going to the Drive-Thru RPG page for it. Hit the sample and look it up there. Just flip through the samples that he's got. It's just a supremely well-written book and a really a fresh approach at fantasy monsters.
I've seen the Monster Overhaul on the DriveThruRPG banner a lot. I think it's like a bestseller or something like that. That's
Yeah,
interesting.
it blew my mind when I got it. It just, oh, it's so good. So good.
It sounds very cool.
So I'm going to shout out the 60th Annual Nebula Awards. The nominations for the awards were just announced a couple weeks ago. So if you are wanting to fill up your TBR pile with a bunch of great novels and novellas and video games and movies to watch, go check that out. Full disclosure, I do help out with the Nebula Awards, but I don't get any money from it. So I just want people to enjoy good stories.
Cool.
Jared recently interviewed Tracy Sizemore for a Gnomecast episode. When this episode you're listening to right now drops, there's going to be a little over a week left on the crowdfunding for Tracy's Savage Worlds setting, Han Cluster. So if you're looking for a sci-fi game with an optimistic spin, please check it out. It is pretty delightful, and I'm very excited to get my hands on it finally. Link will be in the show notes. So, do y'all think this episode was good enough to keep you out of the stew? Or did we send a clone in of you before and it already remembers what you taste like?
Well, I think the stew pot's still pretty full from Stewart being in there.